It's tough to start feeling defensive. I already feel that. I was introduced as the professor of homiletics. And most folks think that's a disease to be cured, not something to be taught. It really deals with the preparation and the delivery of sermons. It comes from the word homily, which was the old-fashioned word for sermon, and rhetoric, so it's the rhetoric of homilies. I was in St. Louis several years ago, and I was introduced as the professor of home economics at the seminar. In fact, that was a bad week. For those of you who are first-timers, I have a lot of bad weeks, so this... But in that service, they had at least two little old ladies. Every preacher, I guess, needs one, but when two of them gang up on you, it's a tough week. One night on the way out, one of them shook my hand and said, Dr. Robinson, I really enjoy your sermons. Your last one is always better than your next. Think about it. Another one put in the old knife. She said, your sermons are like a cup of cold water to a drowning man. I am delighted to be here with Dennis Guernsey. When I was just a little boy, my mother used to take me to hear him preach, and now I'm on the same platform. And I really appreciated the music, haven't you? Hasn't it? When Carnell gets hold of that piano, he doesn't waste any notes. He uses all of them. I mean, we've got a piano in our home, but the ones that notes at both ends are clean and white. We never touch them. It's the six or eight in the middle. What I really like is the guitar. Bob just let it slip that he came from Texas. I spent 19 years in Texas and never really appreciated music till I went down there. And down there, guitar is the music. I mean, if you've never heard the Messiah sung to the guitar, you don't know music. They got special music in Texas. Got some songs like, It's Lonesome in the Saddle Since My Horse Died. Or another one, I'm riding tall in the saddle since the blister broke. But I am delighted to be here. I was glad to see so many new people. I realize most of you came because you saw my name in the folder. We share something in common. You don't know me, I don't know you. The end of the week, we'll both be glad of that. But I am glad to be here at Forest Home. A few summers ago, my wife and I had the opportunity of crossing the United States and going up into Canada and then visiting several countries over in Europe. During that time, we talked to a large number of people. And one of the things that came out of our conversation was that we discovered that a great many people are fed up with the church. A great many evangelicals seem to look at church as a kind of poor substitute for golf on a rainy Sunday morning. And even those who value the church often value it as someone might value an antique spinning wheel. They value it because it is old, but not because it's of any particular use. At any rate, as we were coming home from the trip, my wife, Bonnie, asked me one of those questions, which was really more of a comment. How many people do we know, she asked, who find their involvement in church a meaningful and worthwhile part of their experience? And as I thought of her question, I thought of that small boy who went to his pastor and asked the pastor about the plaque that was hanging in the lobby of the church. The pastor said that the plaque contained the names of the people from that congregation who had died in the service. And the youngster replied, which one, Sunday morning or Sunday evening? And there are a lot of folks, I think, who would not object to the suggestion that instead of awarding attendance pins, maybe we ought to award Purple Hearts or Distinguished Service Crosses. But I'd like to raise that question with you this evening. What's wrong with the church? And I do not raise it as a cynic sitting in the grandstand, but as somebody who is very much a part of the game. What's wrong with the church? Or perhaps to put the question in its most positive fashion, what is the church's greatest need? I suspect that we could go around this audience this evening, and many of you could give some very helpful suggestions. Some of you might feel that the greatest need of the church is for communicators, for men and women who can stand above the din and confusion of our time and speak a sure word from God. Still others might feel that the greatest need of the church is for scholars, for theologians who can study the Bible and bring it to bear on life. And others might feel that the deepest need of the church is for people who have had exciting spiritual experiences, who have felt the touch of God upon their lives and move out to share that touch with others. And all of those suggestions would have a great deal of merit. We certainly do need communicators. In a time when 10,000 seductive voices are luring us to hell, we need people who are able to speak a clear, relevant word from God. What is more, in a time when rose-colored fog often takes the place of Christian doctrine, we need men and women who know the scriptures and are able to apply them to the compound, complex problems of our day. And in those churches that have a theology that's clear as ice and twice as cold, we need a band of God-intoxicated men and women who have sensed God's working in their lives and then move out to share that working with other people. And yet I know of at least one church that has had all of these. In that congregation, there were men and women that could rightly be called prophets. When they stood to speak, people in the congregation, people in the community, recognized that they were hearing an authentic word from God. In addition, there were people in that congregation that were constantly trying to apply the scriptures to the problems of their lives. And in addition, there were folks in that church that had had marvelous spiritual experiences. In fact, some of them had the authentic gift of tongues. They could speak in languages that they had never studied. And yet when Paul wrote to that congregation in the city of Corinth in what is now Greece, he recognized that there was something wrong. On paper, the Corinthian church should have been leading the league. In performance, it was struggling to stay out of last place. Paul recognized that it was a gifted church. In fact, in chapter 1, he says that it came behind no other church in its spiritual gifts. And Paul was no man to downgrade spiritual abilities. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 12, and again in 1 Corinthians 14, Paul urges the Corinthians to use their spiritual gifts to build one another up. But then, having said that, at the end of chapter 12, Paul says to the Corinthians, "But I show you a better path to follow. Instead of pursuing the path of gifts, you ought to pursue the path of love." If you miss it there in 1 Corinthians 12, you can find it again in 1 Corinthians 14:1, where Paul begins that chapter by saying, "Above everything else, make love your aim." And then between chapter 12 and chapter 14, Paul gives us 1 Corinthians 13. Barrett Wendell, the noted Unitarian literary critic, says that 1 Corinthians 13 is the noblest, deepest, finest thing the Apostle Paul has ever written. And what Paul is saying in this chapter is what Helen Hayes, the stage actress, once said about charm. She said that charm is that thing which, if you have it, you don't need much else. But if you don't have it, not much else matters. In this great anthem to love, Paul divides it into three stanzas. And in the first stanza, verses 1-3, what the apostle is saying is simply this, that apart from love, all of our gifts, all of our service, all of our sacrifice amounts to nothing. If I speak with the tongues of men and angels and have not love, I'm a sounding brass and the clanging cymbal. In this chapter, 1 Corinthians 13, Paul is contrasting love with the spiritual gifts he's been discussing in the previous chapter. And the gift that the Corinthian Christians prized most highly was the gift of tongues. Perhaps they valued it because it was showy and spectacular. And so the apostle begins by taking that gift. And he imagines a man who has the gift of tongues as no man or woman on earth has ever had it. This man is able to speak all of the languages of earth and the language of angels as well. Obviously, nobody has ever been able to do that. I once knew one man who could read 34 languages and speak in over half of them. But as far as I know, he never had a conversation with angels. But this man had the linguistic ability to speak every language on earth. Imagine what a magnificent missionary he would have been. One of the staggering problems that the church has had to deal with across the centuries in taking the message of the gospel to the world is that before the gospel can be understood, languages have to be conquered. But this man would not have that problem. Just as soon as he landed at the airport, he could talk to anyone he met. And because he was able to speak with angels, I gather that he was a gifted and skilled orator who could hold his audiences spellbound. And yet Paul says if a man could do that, if he had the linguistic ability so that he could speak any language on earth, if he had the skill of an orator so he could speak with the language of heaven, if he does not have love, he's a sounding brass and a clanging cymbal. The word that Paul uses here for sounding brass is the Greek word chalkos. And the chalkos was a large gong that hung in the trees of pagan temples. Whenever a priest wanted to summon the people to worship, he would slap the gong and the din would be heard throughout the community. The clanging cymbal that he speaks about was also used in pagan worship. It was very much like the cymbals used in a symphony orchestra today. And those two instruments, the chalkos and the cymbal, have one thing in common. All they do is make a loud, senseless din. There's no real music in them. Imagine that last Christmas, somebody gave your children as a Christmas gift an oriental gong and a pair of cymbals. I suspect that you'd be able to get through Christmas Day. Christmas spirit covers a multitude of bad gifts, but I think the problem would come the next morning. You'd be trying to get a little post-holiday sleep in, and the kids would wake up early to play with their new gifts. And they'd come marching into your bedroom. One of them would smash the gong, the other would slap the cymbals, and you'd wake up vibrating from the tips of your hair to the bottom of your feet. Those gifts would put a strain on your nervous system. They put a strain on your friendship as well. Because those gifts, the cymbals and the gong, are capable of only making a loud noise, a senseless din.
And that's what Paul is saying. He is saying that our ability to communicate, our linguistic skills, our oratorical skills, if they are exercised apart from love, are nothing more than a loud noise. I remember a few years ago, a woman talking about her pastor. He was a man noted for his skill in the pulpit, but outside of the pulpit, he was often harsh and at times almost vindictive. And she said more wistfully than critically, you know, when he's in the pulpit and we listen to him preach, we wish he'd never get out of it. But when he's out of the pulpit and we see the coldness of his life, we wish he'd never get back in the pulpit again. And that's something for us to note. Whenever a preacher preaches, whenever a teacher teaches, whenever a Christian communicates with another person, we not only communicate truth, we communicate attitudes and feelings. Feelings about the truth, feelings about the people to whom we speak, perhaps most important, feelings about those who happen to disagree with us. And there is a way in which we can present the truth of God in such a matter-of-fact, loveless way, that the presentation that lacks love is simply a discord, and the message is not heard. Perhaps that was the reason that Jonathan Edwards, the great New England preacher, said, "I have made it the practice of my life never to write an article, never to preach a sermon, unless I am convinced that I am motivated by love for those to whom I write and preach." Apart from love, our gifts accomplish nothing. But in the second verse, the Apostle Paul takes the argument a bit further. And he says that apart from love, all of our gifts, all of our service makes us nothing. If I have the gift of prophecy, and if I have all knowledge and can fathom all mysteries, if I have a faith that can remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. If the Corinthians valued the gift of tongues, it is evident from chapter 14 that Paul valued the gift of prophecy. And now he imagines a man who has that gift. Not only does he have the gift of prophecy, but Paul says he is able to fathom all mysteries. He is able to contain all knowledge. What a welcome addition he would be to the faculty of a theological seminary. There would never be any clouds in his intellectual sky. There would never be any mysteries that he had not delved into and solved. There would never be any questions he could not answer accurately. And what is more, not only does this man have all knowledge and all understanding of all mysteries, but he's a marvelous communicator. He has the gift of prophecy. He has the gift of languages. I know some men who have a tremendous fund of knowledge buried in their minds like the gold at Fort Knox. But when it comes to getting it across to other people, they can't make change for a 10-cent piece. But this man could do it all. He knew the truth and knew it completely. And he could communicate it brilliantly. What is more, Paul says, he has the faith that can remove mountains. I take it that this is the kind of man who starts new ventures, who begins new conferences, who starts new schools, who establishes new missions. He can see a need, and he can see where he wants to go. And even though there is a mountain of difficulty in the way, by his faith, that mountain disappears, and he marches on to what he wants to do. This is the kind of person who's biography we write, kind of person whose biography we read. And yet Paul says if a man or woman could do that, they could prophesy, if they could understand, if by faith they could move tremendous obstacles, if they do not have love, they themselves are nothing. Imagine that last Sunday when you went to the Comma Episcopalian Church, that you put a $20 bill in the offering plate. And imagine that the treasurer of the church took your $20 bill and used it to help pay the salary of your pastor. And then imagine that the pastor took the $20 bill and took it to the grocer and bought some groceries. And then imagine that the grocer took the $20 bill and used it to pay his rent. And the landlord took the $20 bill and used it to help buy a suit of clothes. And then imagine that the clothier took the $20 bill and other bills like it. He took them to the bank. And as the teller is counting out the bills, he comes to your $20 bill. And he discovers that it's counterfeit. All over California, doing good things. It's contributed to an offering. It's helped pay a pastor's salary. It's purchased the groceries, paid the rent, bought clothing. But when it gets to the bank where real values count, it is discovered to be worthless. And so Paul says, that is true with the service that we render with our gifts. It is possible to do a great many impressive things. But when we stand before God, with whom only real values count, if it is seen that what we have done has been motivated by something other than love, Paul says, we ourselves, with all of our service, we ourselves are nothing. In verse 3, Paul carries his argument even further. Not only is eloquence apart from love able to accomplish nothing, and our gifts apart from love, that they make us nothing, but in verse 3, Paul goes on to say that our sacrifices, as impressive as they may seem, apart from love, gain us nothing when we stand at the judgment seat of Christ. For if I give all that I possess to the poor, and if I surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. It is true that you cannot love without giving, but it's equally true that it is possible to give without loving. And Paul imagines a man who gives superlatively. He gives all that he has to the poor. He doesn't just give the interest, he gives the principal. He empties his bank account and gives it to the poor. Some manuscripts say he gives all that he has to feed the poor. And the word that was used for feed is a word often used for the feeding of infants. As you well know, when you feed a small child, you just don't lay it out there in front of them. You actually get involved in the process. Well, this man apparently is pictured as taking all of his possessions and using them to get personally involved in feeding the poor. What is more, he not only gives his possessions, he gives his person. If I give my body to the flames, we don't know exactly what picture Paul has painted on the wall of his mind when he talks about giving his body to the flames. It's possible that he is thinking of those three Hebrew young men who went into a fiery furnace and did that rather than betray their commitment to God. Or perhaps he's thinking of a man who runs into a burning building in order to save a friend who is in danger. Or perhaps he's thinking of something that we know took place in the annals of the early church. Often there were gifted men and women who were in slavery. And there were times when Christians who were free men would sell themselves into slavery in order that the slave might go free and better serve Christ in the community. When that was done, the mark of the branding iron was burned into his flesh. I say we don't know exactly what picture Paul has on the wall of his mind, but the point that he is making is very clear. That is, if you give your body to slavery, or even to death, if you do not have love, you gain nothing at the judgment seat of Christ. I notice that many of you, when you come to these meetings, bring notebooks. And I commend you for that. It's a good way of looking spiritual. The folks behind you will think you're taking notes. When the sermon gets dull, what it enables you to do is to doodle. And it's a way of passing the time so that, it won't be a total waste. And if you want to doodle, let me suggest something that you might do. Take a blank sheet of paper and across the top of the page put a row of zeros. And when you've got a row of zeros, they add up to nothing. And then put down another row and another and another and another and another until you fill the page with zeros. When you're all through, it all adds up to zero. The trouble with dull sermons is that they tend to be long. And so you turn the page over and on the back, put down more zeros and more until you got it filled front and back and maybe a couple of sheets with zeros. See how many zeros you can put down. After you're all through with all those zeros, they add up to nothing. But if you take one zero and in front of it put a one, you get a 10. Two zeros and a one gives you 100. Three zeros and a one gives you 1,000. Six zeros and a one gives you 1,000,000. And there's a sense in which that's what the Apostle Paul is saying about our gifts and our service and our sacrifice. By themselves, apart from love, they add up to naked nothing. But take the smallest gift and minister it in love, and it counts. It counts before God, and it counts with men and women. And we need to note clearly what Paul is saying here, because in our churches, in our seminaries, we put a great deal of emphasis on the ability to understand and the ability to communicate. We put a great deal of stress on sincerity and sacrifice and service. But there can be a kind of service from which all love has been squeezed. There can be a kind of involvement which is little more than the erratic compulsion of duty. There can be an activity for Jesus Christ, the glorying in gifts, that is devoid of love. And Paul is saying that when that occurs, our gifts and our service and our sacrifice, apart from love, accomplish nothing, make us nothing, and gain us nothing when we stand before God. That raises a question, doesn't it? Raises the question that was raised three, four decades ago by the crooner who asked, what is this thing called love? I'm not surprised that he asked, because in our culture, love stands for everything from Hollywood to heaven. It's used to justify the lusts of Hollywood actors and actresses. explain the motives of the Ku Klux Klan. It's used in downtown Los Angeles. You see it on the marquee. Love in the Raw, rated X. Or somebody says, I just love strawberries, but they give me a rash. When you use love that way, and the question is, what does Paul mean when he talks about love? The next four verses, Paul goes on to define love by describing love. In 15 phrases, he tells us what love is by showing us how love acts. He says that love is patient and love is kind. Love does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. Love is not rude, it's not self-seeking, it's not irritable. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, it always trusts, it always hopes. It always perseveres. Paul defines love by describing love. There are some things that the dictionary can never capture. There are some things that just simply cannot be defined in the traditional way. There are some things that can only be defined by seeing them. For example, it doesn't really help you much if you don't know what music is. To define music as the science of the art of tones. Better to hear a duet or a solo on the piano than to have a abstract definition like that. And it doesn't do much good, for example, to define a diamond as native carbon and isometric crystals. Seeing one diamond flashing in the light is better than any kind of dictionary definition. And so in this section, Paul is not defining love according to the dictionary. He's defining it according to life. He shows us what love is by describing what love does. We're going to be looking at this all week long. Tonight, I would just like to make two quick points, and I'll be through. There are two things about love that come out of this section. One of the things that you will see is that the love of which Paul speaks is not primarily an emotion. Many times when we talk about love, we automatically assume that it's some kind of feeling. Dr. John White, a Canadian psychiatrist, has done a number of interesting studies in which he maps all of the kinds of feelings and attitudes that we associate with the word love. There are many kinds of love that really speak to the feelings. There's the love of lovers. You who have been there, and many of you have, know that that can be almost overwhelming. The attraction to that one other person that just seems to occupy your whole life. Marvelous feeling. Delightful part of life. Was the love of parents, the love of mothers. When a mother has wanted to have a child and tried for a long time and then discovers that she is going to have a baby. And finally, when that baby comes and it is brought to her, nobody says to her, now look, you hold the baby. This evening, we have a night nurse that comes on, and she has a way of exhorting you to love that child. And you'll find that after you listen to her talks on love, you'll begin to love your baby. Doesn't happen at all. Beck White says that in many cases, there is actually a biological, biophysical change that takes place in the body of that mother as everything within her reaches out to that infant. You don't control that. It's just there. It happens. It's a marvelous part of life. That kind of love is good and splendid. But the point is, it's not what Paul is speaking about here. The love that he talks about is not primarily an emotion. The love that he speaks about here is primarily an act of the will, a set of the mind, which puts another person's interests before my own and seeks another person's highest good. You can see that in at least two of the things that Paul mentions. He says, for example, in verse 4, that love does not boast. That's one of the 15 descriptions that he gives. You think about that, that's almost strange, isn't it? Paul says that if you love, you don't boast, or if you're boasting, you don't love. I would have thought that the opposite of boasting would have been modesty, or perhaps humility. Wouldn't have thought that the opposite of boasting would have been love, or the opposite of love would have been boasting. Why does he say that? Well, boasting thrives on comparisons. We sometimes say that somebody is proud of being good-looking, or being talented, or being wealthy. That really isn't accurate, is it? We're usually proud of being better looking than other people. We're proud of being wealthier than those around us. We're proud of being more talented than others. So that boasting thrives on comparison, and directly or indirectly, openly or covertly, whenever I boast, what I am doing is using someone else as a platform for my virtue. Inherent in it, there is the putting of other people down in order to build myself up. And that is the essence of selfishness. That is the opposite of love. That's an attitude, not a feeling. That's a set of the mind, not an emotion. It's the essence of this kind of love. Or Paul says in verse 5 that the love of which he speaks is not easily angered. It's not irritable. I find that very hard to understand. I mean, after all, the reason that I get irritable is that I've got things to do. I mean, when my wife, when my children come in and keep wanting a part of my time, and they don't understand that I've got a schedule to keep. I mean, I've got a seminary to run. I've got lectures to prepare. I've got sermons to get. I've got a manuscript to finish. And they want in. That's why I get irritable. It's obvious. Until I stop and realize that they have a claim upon my life. The reason that I am irritable is that I have made myself the center of my little universe. And as long as everybody agrees with me, revolves around my center, fits into my schedule, I can be as nice as the next guy and even a little better. But it's when you interfere with my plans and interplear with what I want to do, that's when I get irritable. But that, in its essence, is selfishness. And it is possible to recognize the claim these people have upon my life. It is possible to adopt an attitude that purifies me. And the irritability that surges can disappear when I put their interests before my own, when I seek their highest good. So this love of which Paul speaks, that we'll be talking about in these evenings to follow, is not primarily an emotion. It is really a set of the mind, an act of the will, whereby I seek another person's highest good and put that person's interest before my own. Over the years, I have found that I have wrestled with this thing called love. And I have found that one of the things that has helped me is to look at this paragraph and apply it to myself. It's interesting when you read the commentaries, one of the things they tell you is that the King James Version uses the word charity. Charity reminds you of a container where you put nickels in at the supermarket. The word they want you to know is really the word love. And then there is the kind of devotional commentary that says that all of these things that you have in these verses really refer to Jesus Christ. That the Lord is patient and kind, and he does not envy, and he does not boast, and he's not rude. That's a very lovely thought. But it's really a pious cop-out. Because here, Paul is not speaking about the Lord. He's talking about the Lord's people. He's talking about you. He's talking about me. This is the kind of person God is making us into. This is the kind of person God wants you, wants me to be. So I found it helpful in my devotional periods to sometimes take this paragraph and in place of the word love, to put my own name. I'd like to do that now, but lest you sit there and mark me down on a number of these points, as I do it for myself, put your name there. Haddon Robinson is patient. Haddon Robinson is kind. He does not envy, and he does not boast, and he's not proud. Haddon Robinson is not rude, and he's not self-seeking. He's not irritable. He keeps no record of the wrongs done against him. Haddon Robinson does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. He always protects. He always trusts. He always hopes. He always perseveres. There are times when I come to the end of that I have to confess not only that I'm an unfaithful person, but I've been an unloving person. But listen, I've got some good news for you. You're better at this than you may think you are. When Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, he said, "You have no need that anyone instruct you to love. The Spirit of God himself is teaching you that. I simply write that you are bound more and more. For this is what God is doing in the lives of those that he indwells."